Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
This is Mike Edison, host of Art Senses a Seizure, as you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, please visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Cutting the Curd, broadcasting live on the Heritage Radio Network. This is your host, Greg Blaze. On today's show, we're going to be continuing the discussion about creating new cheeses. Last week, we talked a bit about the inspiration for Sugar House Creamery cheeses with Margot Brooks and her partnership with Crown Finish Caves here in Brooklyn. We also had our friend Jos Volto crash a party, which was a lot of fun. This week, I'm very excited to have Maisie Jacobs Britchford and Matthew Britchford of Jacobs and Britchford Farmstead Cheese on the line. Thank you guys so much both for coming on today. How you doing?
Great. How are you?
I'm good. I'm suffering a little bit of a cold, so I was glad I was able to get through the pronunciation of all of those Britchfords once. So Leslie and Matthew produce some fantastic award-winning raw milk cheeses in southeastern Indiana from their grass-fed Jersey, Norman, and Tarentaise cross cows. I'd love to start off by asking you about your farm. How'd you get into the business, and why'd you start making cheese?
Well, I've been in the management-intensive grazing and grass farming since the late 80s, and dairy seemed a better way to focus that. And when we started the dairy in 95, we always had the notion of making cheese one day, and we put that off for quite a while, and we've only been running for the past 3 years.
You got the farm in 81, right? Is when you
we moved here. The farm has been in my family since the early 1800s.
Oh, that's fantastic! And it was always So you, but you just said you put off making cheese till about the midnight to the mid 90s or so, or
yeah, no, we just started 3 years ago. I started the dairy in 95.
Right.
We were grazing beef and sheep before that, and then we started with the dairy. We were shipping regular commodity milk. We did not have an organic or we're not certified organic, but we didn't have any marketing opportunities other than direct marketing or the co-op.
Yeah.
And we've always been a New Zealand style seasonal dairy, and
yeah,
we fed grain when we started, but for about the past 18 years we've been grass only. And we just took our time getting the cheese going. We did a lot of research, went to France and visited a lot of farmstead operations, and then we finally got around to do it. And
we're happy to have it. I mean, I was a neophyte to your cheese until I went to visit, not to visit, I went to help build the cheese counter in Italy, in Chicago, as when about 2 years ago when I was introduced to your cheese through a bunch of cheesemongers there, the Amarabella, and I love it. I think it's one of the best raw milk cheeses, best washed rind cheeses, which I collect, that I buy in America. So,
thank you.
Yeah, it's fantastic stuff. It's really like funky and and earthy, which I personally enjoy. But I read on your website that you follow nature's rhythm of milking in this, you said, in a New Zealand-style outdoor parlor, which sounds pretty swanky. So I wondered if you could tell me what that means and about, you know, about that and why that method matters and if that affects your cheese.
Well, the milking method doesn't, but the grazing and then the bean seasonal does. But I'm a farmer that makes cheese. I'm not really a cheesemaker. I've got a lot to learn before I could ever call myself that. And we got in this to find a way to add value to our milk, not so much as a passion for making cheese, but we like to do what we do well. So,
well, you certainly do.
That's what we've tried to do. Our parlor is open air, although we put tarps and things up and freezer flaps to make it a little more user-friendly on the beginning and the end of our season. But we calve starting in mid-March, and we try to be done by early May. We've got some drag on. The hardest thing about having a seasonal herd is keeping them seasonal. And we are seasonal because we do not feed any grain. And we want to have the peak of their lactation coincide with the peak forage production on the farm.
Sure, that's why the milk tastes so good.
Right, and I think that the cheeses that we've chosen to make and are enhanced by being 100% grass-fed.
Yeah, so on last week's episode, the gal I was talking to, Margot, she talked a bit about how she selected the breed of cow for her farm that took into account the geography and the climate in upstate New York and how that affected the styles of cheese that she produces. Did your process for choosing the breeds of cow have anything to do with that?
Today you would think we were in upstate New York because it's in the low teens and snowing here. But
I wish it was in the low teens here.
We have very hot, humid summers. So we're a ways south of the traditional grass dairy belt, you know, around the Great Lakes, so that we've got to try and compensate for that. But the climate plays into that a lot with the grazing.
So you guys are a total family operation, and Maisie, do you help to make the cheese too, or are you?
I have. I would not say that I regularly do. I actually live in Chicago, and so I handle our marketing, and I work with a lot of our distributors and, you know, go out and do demos, kind of talk to the people a bit more, whereas, you know, my parents are on the farm. My dad, you know, makes the cheese and deals with herd management, and then I have another sister who is on the farm, and she, you know, works with the cows and does a bit more on the farm side. So, we're definitely a family business,
awesome.
But I'm not as involved in the production as I am so much in getting it into people's mouths.
Yeah, that's awesome. And did you move to Chicago specifically for that, or did you go to school there?
I am working in another field full time, and then I do the cheese as
help to the family
and a way to be involved with the family business.
Wow, that's pretty awesome. I am. You know, at the Fancy Food Show in San Fran, our producer, Emily Acosta, asked a bunch of cheese professionals, you know, what they thought the most important topic in cheese today was. For our listeners, you can find that episode on the Heritage Radio homepage. And one of the topics that was mentioned was sustainability. And I saw on your website you have this great sentence in your bio that says, "We believe in a sustainable future, and our cheese is one way we can bring that vision to you." And I was wondering if either of you guys would care to elaborate on that for me. Like, what does sustainability mean to you guys?
Matt? Well, for me, I mean, the main, like I said earlier, the main reason for getting into this was to find a way to keep the farm running. Commodity dairying was kind of harsh. At the end of the year, you're thinking, do I want to do this again?
And absolutely.
Rather than looking forward to it, cheese making is a lot more interesting. And then bouncing along with the commodity markets. Of course, you know, all the time, I mean, milk has been really high lately, but it wasn't, you know, for the 10 years prior to that. So that's the main thing about, you know, sustainability, to be able to keep, you know, a viable farm operation. Has been in my family for, you know, close to 200 years, and every generation has had to find a way to make it work. And
yours is cheese. And is that working? Can you see it? Can you see it? I'm bringing you through.
We've come a long way in a hurry, and it's. I mean, we did a lot of background work before we started, but I definitely like it a lot more than what I was doing several years ago. I mean, before we finally pulled the plug and said it's time to make cheese, I was milking 240 cows. twice a day, feeding grain. I had a lot of turnover in labor.
I can imagine.
And I was working about 20 hours a day, and I was pretty well fed up with that.
How the hell do you work 20 hours a day? What, do you hang from a bar in your farm for a few hours at night just to rest up? My God.
Yeah, that's pretty much was the way it went that year. And, you know, when you have livestock, you've got to do that. So anyway, that's when we decided this is it. It's time to – we sold down to 50 cows and then started building our plant at that point in time. But anyway, you know, we needed to find a way to that's a little more comfortable to make a living on a family farm. And by value added and staying as a farmstead business, we're expanding our herd a little bit from where we started, but we only want to be so big, and then we'll make as much cheese as we can, and then if, you know, that's not enough, somebody else will have to make it. And I think that's a more sustainable vision for our rural economy here, and also for us.
Well, the cheese travels further than the milk, I'm sure, right? Maisie, are you getting a lot of good accounts out there in Chicago?
What was that?
Are you getting a lot of good new accounts out there in Chicago and in the surrounding areas?
Yeah, I mean, we work on, I mostly try to work on getting us new distributors. That's just a better way for us to go, because it's kind of more bang for your buck, basically. Yeah. We prefer to work with a couple of distributors that work really well for us, and they can get it to as many people as possible, rather than, you know, deal with tons and tons of individual retail accounts. However, we also kind of try to come at it from both directions. So we work with retailers as well and then put them in touch with our distributors. So we kind of work at it from both directions. And going back to your point about sustainability, I think that, you know, my dad was really touching on about how we do want to make this, you know, a viable business that can continue, particularly looking at the context of our family history on that farm. But we also, you know, look at the cows and the land and how we can have sustainable practices that way. He always says that he's a farmer that makes cheese, and he says he's a grass farmer because we really focus on the grass. And so I think when we're talking about sustainability, it's important to mention those factors as well. We're now working with pigs as well, and we're feeding them the whey. So there really is a holistic approach to the way that we, you know, make cheese. And I think that that's an important aspect, particularly something that I see because I work with the people who are purchasing our cheese, and that's what people really like to hear about, you know.
Absolutely.
They like to see the pictures of the farm. They like to, you know where their products are coming from. And I think that's definitely something that's changed in the market. You know, maybe years ago on the coast and in the metropolitan areas, but we're seeing it, you know, nationwide for sure. And I think that, you know, getting out there, doing demos really helps us kind of tell people more about what our farm is about and what our cheese is about. And the sustainability really plays a part in, you know, what people want to know about.
Absolutely, and that's a good thing that's happening in our world. You get to come on the radio and talk to people like me about your farm and tell us about your cheese, because people want to know that the things that they buy, the things that they're supporting, are supporting, as your dad just said, or you just said to me, Matt, smaller sort of circles of rural agriculture, which
right. And top of that, I you know, the whole know your farmer type of thing, and now we expand a little more than just local, but knowing where your food comes from is so important, and it's the only way to really trust what you're getting is to do your homework and know who's producing it and where it comes from.
Something that worries me always, and it's why I started to do what I do here on the radio, and it's why I've worked with cheese for so long, and I don't think that I knew it when I first started working with cheese, but what I've come to know is that all of these things we do, when you talk specifically about cheese, you're supporting this lifestyle that's very threatened, in my opinion, and could very easily go away. So I always really like to find new producers or producers that are new to me, which you are, and understand that you guys have always been doing for hundreds of years the same thing as supporting those smaller, like those circles of agriculture. But I like that people out there now, like you say, in the heartland of America, or just people in space, places where maybe information wasn't as available to them, know where their food comes from. And I'm sure that that's encouraging to you and your mission, and both as farmers on a small level and as people. Mm-hmm. You know, well, this is a good spot for us to take a break. So when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about some new cheeses that are made on the Jacobs and Bridgeford farmstead. And we will be right back. Cheers.
You are listening to Intrigue by OB City.
The Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board are proud to underwrite Cutting the Curd on heritageradionetwork.org. Wisconsin cheeses have an illustrious heritage of more than 170 years of quality and craftsmanship. During this long and rich history, the art and science of cheesemaking have been captured in time-honored traditions that produce cheese varieties of unsurpassed excellence. Today, Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit www.eatwisconsincheese.com.
This is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, and you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to Cutting the Curd, broadcasting live on the Heritage Radio Network. Before the break, we were talking with Maisie and Matthew of Jacobs and Richford Farmstead Cheese in Indiana about their farm and their cows and their philosophy. And now I'd like to talk a little bit more about your cheeses, guys. First of all, I want to congratulate you on your recent win for Amarabella at the 2015 Good Food Awards. I could and have eaten a lot of that cheese. It's become a standard at my counter, so congrats there. I was wondering if you guys could tell me a little bit, or Matthew, if you could tell me a little bit about your inspiration for making Amarabella, as well as your other two amazing cheeses, Everton and Brianna.
Well, I kind of dropped the ball there earlier when I was talking about the cows, and that figures into what we're doing here. When we started, we had mostly Jersey cows for the grazing purposes, and we found that they were not hardy enough to make it under our program. So we usually, it was a matter of not getting them bred back or whatever. So we burn a lot of cows out that way.
You burned a lot of cows out?
Well, I mean, they don't rebreed. Yeah. They breed late, and then I end up selling them to another dairy or something.
Jersey wasn't the right breed for you.
Well, no, we didn't have the proper Jersey genetics here, or I did not have access to them. So I started looking for something to make my cows a little more dual purpose and a little hardier, and I met Jerome Chateau from Normandy Genetics, and we started crossbreeding with Normandies. And then, as I mentioned earlier, we went to France and visited a lot of farmstead cheese operations, and I fell in love with Tarentaise cattle. And some of my, well, two of the cheeses we were making are that we're trying to copy or emulate are from Tarentaise cattle. Anyway, so that really ties.
Did you visit a lot of dairies or a lot of cheese making operations in eastern France? In the Tarentaise, in the big plain there, you're talking about the Brianna and the Everton?
We went and visited operations. It was in Normandy and Brittany, and also down in Haute Savoie.
Right.
And so that was a great time, and
I'm sure.
A lot. We were hosted by breed associations, and they really bent over backwards to show us what farmstead cheese making was all about, and it was very informative. But so that figured into what types of cheeses we started out with. I wanted to make a good Gruyere, and so we did one of those, and then we wanted something a little younger, and so we picked on our Brianna, so kind of like a Fontina. And we chose that, and then the Amarabella was just kind of a afterthought, and we just decided we needed something that we can get out the door a little quicker, and so we came up with that.
That's the one that goes really well. I mean, I buy a little bit of Brianna, but Vic, Maisie, you were saying about the distribution for your cheese is difficult for me not difficult. I think it's at the early stages in the for me to get it here on the East Coast. I got some Brianna that I really really loved. I guess if I do Food Matters again to get your Amarabella, and we sell a lot of that. Is that Maisie what you sell the most of? Obviously, everywhere.
You know, we do sell the most Amarabella when it comes to amount of bricks sold because, you know, it's small, it's easy, particularly when people want to try something new, it's really easy to buy a 2.5-pound, brick. Right. But volume-wise, we sell a lot of the Everton as well. That one is just sold in those larger wheels, so, it's hard to make that direct comparison because, when people buy a wheel of Everton, they're buying 25 right. pounds of cheese.
It's a different investment.
We sell a lot more poundage of Everton.
So poundage, we're selling as much Everton. But I think we get the Amarabella into more varieties of places, and I think it's more widely available.
That's surprising to me, just as a cheesemonger bee. Well, it is and it isn't, because, the Amarabella is this stinky sort of squishy, gooey cheese that would seem to appeal to a smaller amount of people. But yet you use that to get in first because you have so much of it. And you said the Everton – yes?
It's interesting, like with the Brianna, it is definitely the public's favorite whenever we do demos. Places the public likes the Brianna the most. However, it's not that way with distributors. So I don't know what we have to do to make that make it more appealing to them. But so we'll
it'll work itself out. I mean, in my experience, you'll find a cheese shops as you spread out a little bit more and a little bit more. The Brianna is my favorite too. I had a wheel of it. I pre-ordered it through Food Matters again, got it in, and I brought it up to our beer restaurant at Italy called the Benedia, and they were doing a beer tasting up there. And everybody just flipped out over it, you know. And then, but I only had one wheel of it, you know. And then I either got lazy or stupid or both, and I didn't reorder it, you know, because distributors think it's harder for them just to have those larger wheels. They don't want them lying around. I didn't know that was a Fontina recipe, though. Because I sell a lot of Fontina, I run an Italian cheese shop. But that's interesting for me to know. Yeah, I really liked Brianna. It was my favorite. It has this really weird greenish hue that I like about it. And I love the curdy nature of the cheese. That's interesting.
It's a washed curd cheese. So, you know, like a Fontina.
So the Everton's a Gruyere recipe. So how long typically is that aged out?
7 or 8 months is about the earliest we want to let it go. Now, we have our premium reserve, which is something we have that's close to 2 years old, and we really like that. It's very sharp, and it's been doing well.
So you've been holding on to some of those wheels for almost as long as you've been making and selling cheese then?
Yeah. We with the Everton's, we kick a few back out of every batch and save them for that. The Brianna does not have that kind of lifespan.
Does it not? What do you do those at about eight months? You said 6 or 8 6 months.
Yeah. 7 or 8 months generally is when we get really get the flavor we want.
Yeah, that's some fantastic stuff. We got to work on getting more of that out here because I will do that. I will get right on that. I also Emily brought us back some of your newest cheese called Adair. Is that a correct pronunciation?
Yes, and it's an old Scottish surname that's common in my family. That a lot of women in my family have had that as a middle name. But
Adair,
We tend to that's where we go for names,
nice.
Family in the community. Yeah.
That's cool. So can you tell us about that? What's your recipe origin there, and what was the inspiration for making that?
Well, we started off. I mean, it's another Tarentaise type of cheese as a Reblochon, and it's we're far from that, but that's what we. I worked with. One of our culture suppliers to help come up with Reblochon recipes, and I took several of them and synthesized them and came up with what we're doing now.
That's a lost cheese. That's a great cheese, Reblochon, and it's one that I just can't get them anymore. Obviously,
you can't get a raw milk one. And because they're like a 45-day cheese or something like that, but
yeah.
We bought a pasteurized one at a cheese event we were at recently, and it was terrible.
Yeah, it's not good. it's not good
it
stuff.
It was really bad.
Yeah, you got to either like smuggle in those green label ones, which obviously I would be above doing. I would never do something like that.
You're not.
It's not that kind of guy. But the other ones aren't good. So these are great. I mean, when we tasted it, it was a little younger. It was firm, and it had the Amarabella has this sort of long beginning and end, and this one was quick and clean finish. It was a little acidic, in a pleasant way. But are you still in developmental stages of that, or are you?
We're
you're selling
to
it.
Move some now, and we start production again here in a few weeks. But I've got there's a lot of things we need to tweak on that, but. All the rest of our cheeses are very much on the savory side, so we wanted to do something that was a little more lactic and a little smoother
you wanted to go a different way.
Different, yeah.
Totally. So, Macy, as far as marketing the cheese goes, and this is because you have these for certain flavor profiles fits in, do you have a particular strategy for positioning your cheese in the market? I mean, do you intentionally want to be known for one particular cheese like Amarabella, or how do you match all of these things you're doing with your animals and your cheese making processes, with actually making money and selling cheese?
Well, I mean, I think that we, you know, we only have four cheeses, so I think that we very easily can stick in consumers' minds with all four of those cheeses. So we don't want to be known just as, you know, the people who make Mirabella.
Yeah.
Although, you know, we are, and we're proud of the Mirabella, but we do want to, you know, work to continue to find markets for all four of our cheeses. And the beauty of the Adair, which is the new cheese, is that it is also small format. So we think it'll be another cheese to help open doors. Because that's, you know, that's kind of what the Mirabella has been for us. Because when we first started, the Mirabella was, first of all, it was available first. So because of the aging. So, you know, it was 2 months old, and that's what people got. That was the first impression, basically. And then as the other cheeses became available, we had used, you know, we went to the people who were already carrying the Mirabella and had them try our other cheeses, and, you know, that kind of opened the door. And we think that the Adair will also help do that, particularly because it is a milder profile. I think it's going to find a pretty wide audience. And I think that will continue to help the sales of all the cheese. Because we kind of see that each of our cheeses fills a different niche. And we like to think of our cheeses, you know, as they're versions of cheeses that you could get in Europe, but they're an American take on them. And so we feel like we're filling a market need that is not necessarily met through other American producers. And so I think that, you know, I love it when we do demos and, you know, sometimes there are people who are visiting from France or Italy and they get so excited about our cheeses.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they didn't know that they could find this being made in the United States. And that's always, you know, a really good feeling for us because we're, you know, bringing some of that taste of Europe.
Yet the cheeses are distinctly yours.
You know, Indiana.
Yeah.
and so we definitely think we're kind of, we're going for a small section of the market, but we're just trying to do it really well. And hopefully, you know, each of our cheeses fits into a different niche, and I think so far that that's working well for us. I mean, obviously, we have room to grow, but we're still young. So I definitely think we're on the right path.
You ever think you're going to make a blue cheese?
Getting all the different cheeses out there.
Matthew, do you ever think you'll make any blue cheese?
No, I haven't thus far. But never, I haven't ruled it out.
There is a weird blue cheese I got that always reminds me of the Tarente's, the place where it was a big, massive block of cow cheese that they just sort of allowed. They just allowed the oxygen sort of penetrate the rind. The Blue Dip Termignon, I think it was called, and I haven't seen it in years. For some reason, the paste of your Brianna kind of reminded me of that cheese. Just an offshoot question, but you guys also have some sheep, right?
Well, I didn't think
right?
about it. So.
Yeah?
I haven't done that yet.
You guys also have a little bit, a small flock of sheep, right?
Yes, we have some, they're hair sheep, so they're pretty much kind of a free range.
Would you ever consider making cheese from the milk of other animals, like sheep, or maybe yours?
As long as I don't have to milk them.
All right.
I'd love to be able to buy goat's milk and do something in the winter when we're down. But we're pretty busy here already, so I'm not going to start a goat dairy. But
no, you don't have enough.
Somebody else wanted to. I would welcome that, but I'm not going to.
Maisie, are you going to come back and run that?
No, I'm quite content doing less of the manual labor.
Well, you guys see also.
All my girls grew up milking cows, so.
Yes. Yeah. I personally feel like I got myself with that.
Yeah, you pass through that. You pass through that portion. So then you get.
Yes.
Well, that's awesome. I mean, you guys sound like a great family team, and you know, I love your cheese. I want to thank you so much, both of you, for coming on the show today. I love your cheeses, truly, and it's a pleasure getting to talk to you. For all of you out there, be sure to check out our Instagram, Cutting the Curd, one word, for some sexy pictures of Jacobs and Bridgeford cheese, especially the Amarabella. And so I want you guys to tune in next week for Diane Snepple's book review. Hope you had a great time listening. Have a good week. Cheers.
The theme song for Cutting the Curd is Cheese Gainsburg by Tackstar.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola El Waley, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.